Broadcasting live from Whitman Field, this is AirVenture on EAA Radio, Oshkosh.
Please join me in welcoming back to our stage for what will be another exciting and entertaining evening of aviation legends, Mr. David Hartman.
Hey, Dave. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hi, evening all. We have the special treat tonight because we have for you to get acquainted with three truly great American aviators, Dick Cole, Joe Kittinger, and Joe Engel. The first is Lieutenant Colonel, retired, Dick Cole from the United States Air Force. He had a distinguished 27-year career in the Air Force. He retired in 1967. He was one of the pilots of the B-25 crews that bombed Tokyo in April of 1942, just 4 months after Pearl Harbor. He earned a DFC with two Oak Leaf clusters, an Air Medal with the Oak Leaf cluster, the Bronze Star, the Air Force Commendation Medal, and the Chinese Army, Navy, and Air Force Medal. Welcome, please, Colonel Dick Cole. We got you over there. That's you. Dick, when did you earn your wings? What year did you get your wings?
1941 in July.
So when Pearl Harbor happened, December 7, 1941, where were you?
We were in transport from the southeast U.S. to back to Pendleton. We stopped off at March Field, and they gave us permission to go over into Los Angeles for the weekend, and everybody was in the Hollywood Plaza Hotel.
Hollywood Plaza, yeah. Pearl Harbor, not bad place to be on Pearl Harbor Day. At what point, when did you learn about this, what became the Doolittle Raiders? How did you learn about it, and when did you learn about it?
We were stationed at Pendleton, Oregon, and were transferred to Columbia, South Carolina in February of 41. We flew out of Columbia for a while, and we were there maybe a month. And one day, there was a notice on the bulletin board in front of the squadron headquarters. They wanted volunteers, and so I placed my name there.
And what were you volunteering for?
I had no idea.
I mean, looking back on it, was it a good call, or?
I think so.
So do I. So when did you learn what you had volunteered for, and from whom?
2 days after we set sail from California, they announced on the PA system that this force is bound for Tokyo.
But you had volunteered to fly B-25s, yeah, as a unit, yeah, right?
Yes.
How much training did you do for this mission before you went to San Francisco to board the boat?
We trained about 45 days with a myriad of training things, low-level bombing, long-range navigation, testing the weight of the aircraft, because we wanted to take off, or try and take off, with a full load off of a dry runway, which was marked off with carrier markings.
So you knew that you were going to fly from an aircraft carrier?
Yes, sir.
You did?
Yes.
So you go to San Francisco, right?
Right.
To get on the Hornet. So when did they get the airplanes on the Hornet?
They put the airplanes on the Hornet the 1st of April, and we left on the 2nd.
Of the 2nd. How many airplanes did they put on the ship?
They put 16 aircraft on board and had the intention of the 16th airplane taking off when we were about 2 or 3 hours out of San Francisco to show everybody that it could be done.
And that plane was scheduled, then would have to fly back, of course, to the mainland, right? Yeah. So you were going to have 15, but you wound up with 16.
Yeah.
They canceled. Was that the original number of aircraft that was planned for the boat, or were more planned for?
No, just 15.
15, yeah. That was it. Mm-hmm. So you depart from San Francisco on the Hornet.
Right.
What was the attitude of the Navy people toward all of you Army Air Corps guys?
Well, not everybody, but some of the Navy people were a little perturbed because, number one, there were a group of Army carpetbaggers had put all their airplanes on the deck, and in that case, they had to put their airplanes in the second deck. And cluttered up the companionways with cots because we didn't have any other place to sleep. So it upset their routine, basically.
How much security was there around this whole operation from the moment you heard about it in South Carolina?
When we arrived at Eglin, we were pretty much isolated.
And you were told nobody could say anything about what you were doing?
No, we were told not to even talk about it among ourselves.
Really? So when you got on board ship, I mean, you didn't know until you took off from San Francisco exactly where you were going?
No, most of us thought that we knew we were going to take off of a carrier.
Right.
It was pretty obvious. We thought that we were going to be taken to some place in the Pacific where they had an airfield. We would take off from the carrier and land on that airfield and start fighting the war.
Right. When did you learn exactly what your mission was going to be, and what did they tell you?
When he announced that this force was bound for Tokyo, then they brought out all the maps and things like that, briefing stuff. And it happened that the first airplane target was northwest Tokyo. And we had nothing. We had 400 or 500 pound incendiary bombs. Okay. And our job was to drop those over northwest Tokyo and light it up. For two reasons. One, to give the other following airplanes a reference as they came in, and also for the airplanes that were going down the island chain to Nagoya and Kobe.
Who was your, you were a second lieutenant at the time, flying right seat. Yeah. Who was your aircraft commander in the left seat?
Well, I'm happy to say that I was lucky enough to be with Colonel Doolittle.
Dan Bolin yesterday, who spoke with Dick yesterday, said this, and I'm just repeating what Dan said. Most of us observe history. Once in a while, somebody comes along who made history, and this gentleman happens to be one of them.
I don't like to be singled out because there are numerous other young guys like myself and a lot of people all over the world, the free world, that were doing their job, and that's what we were doing.
Tell us about Colonel Doolittle. What was he like? He was a lieutenant colonel then. What was he like?
Surprisingly, he's a very quiet man. He treated everybody with respect, and anybody in the crew or in the whole 80 men that were involved had a shot at coming up with a good reason or a good plan or a gripe and so forth. He was a team man, and teamwork worked very well.
Now, I understand that there was a plan for when the distance from Japan, when you were to launch, but that was jumped. You had to launch early. Why? What happened?
The original plan was that we were to launch on the 19th of April at dusk and fly all night, bombing Tokyo in the middle of it, and going on to China, and landing at a pre-designated field, and gassing up, and going over to Kunming, China, which is in the western part, where the AVG were operating out of. As it was, early in the morning, the people on the Enterprise made radar contact, surface radar contact, with a Japanese ship. And it turned out to be the Nita Maru. And it was really a fishing boat with a long-range radio on it. At that time, they decided to play it close to their chest for a little bit, but around 7 o'clock or so in the morning, it got to where they were, they had seen us. According to the history records, they did send a message back to Tokyo that they had seen two carriers, but the people in Tokyo decided to wait for confirmation. At 8 o'clock, Admiral Halsey decided to launch. And at that time, we were 250 miles farther out than we were planned. The Navy had given us an indication that they would take us within 400 miles. And at about the 650-mile point, we launched.
So what did that do to your fuel plan situation and your overall plan for recovery in China?
Well, right away, when we had to launch, why fuel became a problem. We had put 10 5-gallon cans of gas in the back of each airplane that the crew chief gunner could dump into the tank that we had replaced with the bottom turret. And we didn't know how far that was going to carry us, but we had to launch, and we flew along after we bombed and headed out over open sea toward China. Hank Potter, the navigator, passed a note up to us that according to his figures, we were going to run out of fuel about 150 miles short of the Chinese coast.
That was after the
yeah,
bombing.
Yeah.
While we're talking, can we roll the film silently? Because I think you can both listen to Dick and hear this film as it rolls. Where's the screen?
It's in the back.
Where? Where? I can't see anything. Oh, yeah. Okay. Thanks. All right. So you approach the Japanese coast. Were you flying formation or were you single plane all on your own?
No, it was never planned that we would fly formation. Number one, we couldn't use the fuel that it took to do that.
And rendezvous would have used up too much gas.
Second, it was planned singly, a low-level mission individually.
Right.
And in the picture, you'll see formation flying, but those things were dubbed in to complete the picture, I guess.
You approached your target?
Yes.
And that was what, in northwest Tokyo?
Northwest Tokyo.
And what happened?
We shored into Tokyo about 20 miles north and picked up our bearings and turned south. And Fred Bramer, the bombardier, when he recognized some objects that he had picked out on the carrier from the photographs that we had, well, he advised Colonel Doolittle, and Colonel Doolittle pulled up to 1,500 feet, and we dropped our bombs and went back down on the deck.
And they were incendiaries?
Yes.
And they worked?
Yes.
And what did that part of Tokyo look like after you dropped the bombs?
Well, we didn't stick around, so I really can't say.
So you went back down on the deck, and which direction did you go then to get your way eventually to China?
We flew south out of Japan and about 75 miles or so before we turned toward China. We didn't want the Japs to see us turn toward China.
Was this still daylight, or is it now getting dark?
Oh, no. Because we had to leap early, we were over Tokyo at high noon.
Wow. So how was the, what were the winds, and what was the trip toward China?
Well, according, unbeknown to us, because we all thought we were going to run out of fuel, there was a big front over China at the time, and it created a east-west wind, which gave us a 35-mile tailwind. When we got to Hank Potter's point where he said that we would be out of fuel, we still had fuel, and the water was beginning to turn brown. So we knew it was coming off of land, and we figured we had a tailwind. So we kept flying, and we arrived over the Chinese coast at dusk. The weather was raining and so forth, and you couldn't see the ground or the ocean. So we pulled up to 9,000 feet and stayed on the same heading.
And when did you bail out? I mean, was it when you ran out of gas or before that?
There was supposed to be a homing, a portable homing station installed at Chuchao, the place we were supposed to land. Well, that airplane that was carrying it to Chuchao crashed, and so there was no homing station. In addition, the Chinese, hearing our engines, thought we were Japanese, and they thought it was an air raid, and shut off all electricity. One other thing is that we couldn't have done much about it anyway, because the weather was socked in clear to the ground, and we had no way of making approach to the terrain there. It was fairly mountainous.
What was the bailout like?
Very shaky time. to me, that was I guess is the correct word, the scariest time. Standing there, looking at the black hole in an airplane about ready to run out of fuel. On the good side, we all bailed out successfully, and nobody was injured.
And where did you land?
A Lady Luck was with me. My chute drifted over a pine tree, and I ended up in the tree about 12 feet off the ground. So I spent the night like our ancestors in the tree.
What happened? Was the crew able to get together? And what happened, your crew? And what happened to all the other airplanes trying to get to China?
The next day, we all, I don't know which direction they started out in, but I had a compass, and I knew that if I walked west, that I would be walking away from the Japanese area. After walking all day, I came out on a cliff, and down below was a little cantonment military, and it had a Chinese flag flying above it. So I walked down there, and I was accosted by a young Chinese soldier. He took me to a building, and in the building was a piece of paper that had a sketch of a two-tailed airplane with five parachutes coming out of it. And after a few minutes of hieroglyphics and so forth to try and get them to take me to where they had taken the individual that drew the sketch, they did. And I walked in this building, and this sketch artist happened to be Colonel Doolittle. I said, boy, am I glad to see you.
Oh, man. Wow. So that was your crew came together.
Yes.
What about the other 15?
Well, that was one thing that Colonel Doolittle was a bit adamant with Washington about. Right away, they started sending messages. They wanted him to come home.
Him or all of you?
No, him. He refused because he wanted to know where every airplane had crashed and the status of the individual. And it was a particularly hard time for him because he had visions that he might go to end up in Leavenworth. And he said so, having lost all airplanes and not knowing where the crews were and so forth. But I know that he refused two messages from Washington.
The other crews, did all of the crew members of all the airplanes survive?
No, the two airplanes ditched. And in the ditching, two other members were drowned. And they are the people that ended up being captured. The eight people. One died in prison from beriberi, and four of them came home.
Right.
They executed three, two pilots and a gunner.
There is a story, Nolan Herndon?
Yes.
Did you know Nolan Herndon?
Yes.
Well, he is quoted in a newspaper article in 2001 in a South Carolina newspaper as suggesting that his airplane, instead of going to China, his was the only airplane that went to the Soviet Union, to Vladivostok. And he suggested in this article that it was pre-planned, that it was an intelligence gathering decision, and that his two pilots, he said, spoke Russian, and that they were there to find out whether the Russians were really our friends and or what the airfields were in case we needed them at some point, perhaps, to bomb Japan. To what extent do you think there's any truth to any of that?
Well, it's true what he said, but it's also logical that that was the reason they went to Russia. But I don't think you'll ever get anybody to admit it.
That was the case?
Yes.
Well, I sent this an email to Jimmy Doolittle III, who many of you know, and he's a former commandant of the test pilot school at Edwards and an aviator. But this is what Jimmy III wrote back to me. He said, Grandpop didn't talk much about the war. He did grin about Roscoe Turner, Poncho Barnes, the flying during the golden years of the 20s and 30s, and the flight test gang at Old McCook Field, where he worked for the Army Air Corps flight test establishment in the mid-1920s. He said, the Russian connection regarding the espionage theory makes a good speculation, might be the truth, but I've not heard anything about it except that they were running low on gas and decided it was a long swim and went to Vladivostok against orders. And then Jimmy suggested, well, we did send Gary Powers to fly over Russia and then denied it until the Russians produced a live Gary Powers and a bunch of pieces of a U-2 airplane. So who knows what might have gone on back in 1942, but we're never going to know.
Well, a logical conclusion would be that Stalin didn't want to fight a war on two fronts because he had his hands full with Germany. And the idea, which came out later, was that they would use Midway as a takeoff point and shuttle bomb over Japan and land in Russia. But like I say, I don't think you'll get anybody to admit it.
Now, what was promised to you if you did this fabulous mission and succeeded? What did the government say, or the Army Air Corps say, was going to happen with you all when you, after you did this great thing?
Well, one of the carrots that they hang in front of you was that if you survived the mission, you get to come home. That's all well and good, except there were 20 of us that something happened to the orders, went to file 13 or something, and we didn't receive any orders. And you had a choice of going to AWOL and Leavenworth or doing your job.
So what did your job become? I mean, what happened? You're in China? You got out of China. Where'd you go?
I was assigned to the 11th Bomb Squadron at Kunming, China. And after a month or so, we ended up with about four airplanes and some 30-some pilots. I don't remember the number, but it was two.
So you were in Chiang Kai-shek territory.
Yeah.
Right.
And they put out a feeler for people to fly the hump in transport.
And, CBI?
Yes. And three of us decided that that's what we wanted to do, so we went over on the hump and flew the hump for 14 months and came home.
How did this whole experience affect the rest of your Air Force career?
Well, I think it stood me in good stead because gave me the opportunity to get accumulate quite a few flying hours, which that was the name of the game as far as I was concerned. Anyway, so.
As you look back over your career, how does this fit in terms of excitement or scariness, to use the word you used? Where does this fit into your whole life career story?
I guess the main thing is that I realize that I've been very fortunate and very lucky. Yeah.
Dick Cole, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir. Lieutenant Colonel Dick Cole.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Joe Kittinger, would you come out, please? Hello, Joe. Yeah, here he is. Here's Joe Kittinger. I want him to have to sit here while I do his whole CV and see if he'll get embarrassed. Right. Air Force Colonel, retired. 28-year career, retired in 1978. He set so many records, jumping from high-altitude balloons, doing aerospace research, earned the 1960 Harmon Trophy. He flew 483 missions in Vietnam. They were all volunteer missions. He shot down a MiG, but was then shot down himself in May of 1972 and spent 11 months in the Hanoi Hilton as a prisoner of war. He earned 2 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, 6 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 3 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts, 24 Air Medals. He's a fellow of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots. In 1997, he was inducted into the Aviation Hall of Fame. He has some 16,000 hours of flying time. As a kid, he raced boats in Florida, went to the University of Florida, earned his wings, went to Germany in a fighter bomber wing, and then to Holloman Air Force Base. This is Colonel Joe Kittinger. Tell me about Colonel John Paul's Dr. Stapp.
Well, when I got to Holloman, Dr. Stapp was the chief of the Air Med Lab, and I was in the fighter test section. And one day my boss said, we just got a request from the Air Med Lab for a pilot to fly the zero gravity work. And I raised my hand immediately, because I always volunteer for anything. And I went over there, and Dr. Stapp briefed me that when we go into space, we're going to have periods of weightlessness, and we don't have any human subjects that have gone through this, so we're going to start a program. Now, Dr. Stapp was a visionary. He knew we were going to go into space. Am I working?
You know what it is? I bet it's, let me see, hold on, let me see. Maybe it's somewhere outside. Here, talk a little bit.
One, can two, three. Can you hear me now?
Is that working? No? No, sorry.
How about that?
Hold on. Test, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, get close to it, it's okay.
How about that?
Yeah. So start over about Dr. Stapp, please.
Now let's see, I came in the door. Oh, no, okay.
Rim shot. Oh, sorry.
When I got to Holloman, Dr. Stapp was stationed there, and I was in the fighter test section. One day, my boss asked us at a meeting, we need a volunteer to fly a zero gravity experiment over in the Air Med Lab. And he said, I don't know what in the hell that is, but I need a volunteer. And I immediately stuck my hand up, and I went over there, and Dr. Stapp said, well, you know, when we go into space, man is going to be weightless for a long period of time, and we've never done any real research to see if man can adapt to that condition. So Dr. Stapp was a visionary. He knew we were going to go into space, and he knew that there was certain information we needed, and that was one of it. And I flew those missions, and you'll be interested in this. The first mission I flew was in a T-33. And I would dive down real steep and then pull up and push on the pole. And we had very sophisticated instrumentation. It was a golf ball on a string. I swear to goodness, that's the truth. And when that golf ball floated, that was zero gravity. But anyway, we went from there to more sophisticated instrumentation and longer periods of time. We went from that to the 94C, to the F-89, to the F-100, to the F-104. And all of these giving us more and more time in zero gravity. And they determined that that was not a factor that was going to prevent us from going into space.
The when he was on the high-speed sled, now you flew, in a sense, Chase, right?
I flew Chase. He was doing 614, I was doing 350.
And he was on the sled, but tell him about that, in case you don't know what Dr. Stapp did to himself.
Well, let me tell you that Albuquerque is 250 miles away from Alamogordo, from Holloman. And when that sled fired, it reached 614 miles an hour. I figured the first bounce would be Albuquerque, because that sled went from zero to 614 miles an hour and stopped in 3,500 feet. Now that's a drag racer when you think about it.
Oh man!
And he pulled minus 41 G's deceleration. He was just one hell of a man and a great visionary and a brave individual.
So when did the balloon business begin? The Man High project, was that the first balloon project?
Once again, Dr. Stapp knew we'd go into space. We'd never put a man up in the space environment. We didn't have the life support system. We didn't have the physiological monitoring devices, the communications, the astronaut selection, the training. And that was the purpose of this Man High program. And we had to do it. The only way we could do it was with a balloon back in 1957. And that was the purpose of the flight, to determine the design configuration and the life support system and so forth. And I made the first flight to 97,000 feet in June of 1957 for the first flight of the Man High. and as a test pilot. And then there was two more flights after that Manhattan
program. So what would you wear?
We wore a pressure suit, MC-1 pressure suit, in case we lost pressurization. And by the way, the capsule was 3 feet across and 7 feet high. I used to tell everybody that's the size of a telephone booth, but hell, today you don't know what, nobody knows what a telephone booth looks like, so. But it was 3 feet across, 7 feet high.
So what happened in that first, that was your first significant jump,
that
yes?
was. And I went up to 97,000 feet and gathered the information we needed, and it was a very successful flight because we were doing this for the space flight that was coming on. And when NASA got ready to go on the Mercury program, we had already done some of the basic research that they needed to build upon. There's no such thing as giant leap in anything. Everything is done incrementally. Everybody contributes little bits of knowledge, and you end up with a final product. And this was just one of the small products that we developed, Dr. Stepp developed, for our space program.
So describe that first jump particularly. I mean, how did you do it? Were you like a skydiver, or how do you go out?
This was not a jump program. This was one that was pressurized. That was a man high. Yeah. You want me to talk about the jump?
Well, you tell me what's most significant that we need to hear to understand what you did.
Well, can we run the tape?
Sure.
Can we see it?
Sure. Run the tape, please.
The crew, who were totally in awe of Kittinger's courage and determination.
Kill a sound on the tape, please.
Turn the sound off. I'm the soundtrack. Thank you.
Great.
First of all, the reason this program was accomplished was because we knew we were going to space. A man was going to get outside and had to do work. We had never had a man in actual space environment. We'd gone up in altitude chambers, but we'd never actually been outside of a spacecraft in 1959. The other purpose was to develop a means of escape from very high altitude. And we knew that there was a serious problem because we had dropped dummies and they were spun up to 200 RPM, which would kill a man. So the goal was, if we'd had an aircraft that could have taken me up there to 100,000 feet and eject, that would have been a lot simpler way to do it. The balloon was a pain in the butt because you had to have perfect weather, perfect conditions, but unfortunately there was not an airplane that would get us to those altitudes. So we had to use a balloon to get up there. The balloon complicated it because when I jumped out, I had to free fall 16, 17 seconds to reach terminal velocity. Whereas if I could have ejected, I would automatically be at terminal velocity. So there was a handicap there. Where are we on the screen?
Screen? Well, I still don't know because I can't see anything.
Are they? Which way is the flag? Okay, I got it.
You see it over here?
Okay. Oh, I can see it. Did it just start? No. We didn't do this to set records. We did this to gather information that our Air Force and our country needed. And that's a very important point to remember. And also, I was doing it as a pilot, as an astronaut. I was not doing it as a skydiver or a parachute jumper, because astronauts are not skydivers. Astronauts are not parachuters. So I was there to represent the future people who are going to use this equipment. We did a 100 altitude chamber test to 100,000 feet, 100 degrees below zero, in preparation for the jump. We were finally ready to go, and I made the first jump from 76,000 feet. Unfortunately, when I got there and got ready to jump, I had the difficulty in getting out of the seat. So instead of free falling for 16 seconds, the timer was inadvertently started before I jumped out. So when I jumped out, I only fell 2.5 seconds, and the pilot chute wrapped around my neck, and the parachute could not deploy. Now, I knew it was going to be a damn interesting fall, because I'd watched the dummies do the free fall from that altitude, and now I was going to be the dummy. And I started free falling, and I started turning the left, and I stopped it, and I started turning the right, and I stopped it. And then I had a sudden turn to the left, and the centrifugal force was so great I couldn't pull my arms in. I had a real interest in my altimeter and stopwatch at that time. But the centrifugal force was just too great, and I became unconscious.
So the stopwatch altimeter is on your wrist?
On my left wrist.
But you couldn't get it in?
I couldn't get my wrist in because of the centrifugal force.
You were spinning.
Yes. So anyway, I became unconscious, and my reserve parachute opened at 10,000 feet and saved my butt. Dr. Stapp and I had to go back up to the headquarters and convince them to let me go ahead with a second jump. And when I got with the generals, I said, General Schriever, I said, sir, we just demonstrated why we need to do this program. We just demonstrated that a man, an astronaut, or a pilot jumping from 76,000 feet could enter a violent spin. And I only got 120 RPM, but I could have gotten up to 200. So they approved it, so I made another jump a month later. And then finally, in August the 16th, 1960, I jumped from 102,800 feet. It took me 90 minutes to get up there. At 40,000 feet, I discovered my glove, my right hand, was not working. And I didn't tell the folks on the ground because I knew they would cancel me, and I didn't want them to do that. So I continued on and didn't tell them. I got to 102,800 feet, couldn't go any higher. I drifted 11 minutes. I went through a 46-item checklist. I stood up, said a silent prayer. Now, I'm telling you, that was one hell of a prayer, too. The most fervent prayer I ever said in my life. And I hit a button on the gondola and jumped out. And I fell a little bit, and I rolled over my back. And I looked up, and that balloon was firing into space. And then I realized the balloon was standing still, and I was going down like a scalded dog. I ended up doing 714 miles an hour. I was the first man to go supersonic by an airplane, and that's energy conservation at its best. Gravity is a law, and by gum, I demonstrated it. I fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds. The main parachute opened, and I landed safely on the desert. We were absolutely elated because we had done what we set out to do. Now, you know what we did. Now, let me just tell you why we're so proud of what we did. I had a great team of folks. I had 13 folks of my team, enlisted guys, civilians, engineers, Air Force folks, and we all worked together with the same common goal. And we were there because Dr. Stapp gave us the opportunity and the tools to do it with. The information we obtained on getting outside of a spacecraft was used later on by NASA. The escape system that we developed is still being used today. Every ejection seat in the whole world has a 5-foot diameter drogue chute that is attached to the seat until it gets down to anaerobic altitude. So what we did back in 1959, 1960 is still being used today, and that makes us all very proud of that. Now, 6 years after I made my jump, there was a guy by the name of Bill Weaver flying an SR-71 at 90,000 feet doing Mach 3.1. And the flying machine came apart. He got ejected out of the aircraft, and he survived. So here we know that system will work at Mach 3.1 at 90,000 feet because it's been demonstrated. So we were very proud of what we did, but it was only because of a great team that I had and Dr. Stapp, and I was a lucky guy that got the chance to do it.
Boy.
That was a long, long declaration.
But that wasn't the end of you and balloons. What was Stargazer?
Well, Stargazer was another one that Dr. Stapp approved. This was a basic science research project where I took an 8-foot diameter pressurized gondola up to 87,000 feet with a gyro-stabilized 12.5-inch Cassegrain telescope with a trained astronomer. And we went up to 87,000 feet and looked at planets and Earth and stars that had never been seen before. It was a phenomenal program. And unfortunately, we had a few malfunctions on the additional attempts, the follow-on attempts, and the project was canceled. And the Air Force said, Kettinger, do something else. Well, about that time, the Vietnam was starting, and I was a fighter pilot, and I still am a fighter pilot, by the way. And I felt I owed it to my country, I owed it to my Air Force, and so I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I flew my first tour in 63, 64 in B-26s. Then I went back. I took 8 A-26s across the Pacific in June of 66, 67. I flew a combat tour out of Nong Khom Phanom, which we call Naked Fanny, by the way. And I don't know why we call it that, but we did. Anyway, in 1967, that tour was over. And I volunteered then in 1970 to go back, and I went back over there in F-4 Phantoms, which I was delighted because I'm a fighter pilot and a Phantom is a great airplane. I was made a squadron commander of the Triple Nickel, which was the greatest fighter squadron there was. And by the way, Steve Ritchie was the weapons officer, captain of my squadron, and I taught that guy every damn thing he learned. So, and tell him that, he'll agree with me. But anyway, I shot down a MiG and on the 1st of March, 1972, a MiG-21. And then on the 11th of May, 1972, the world's greatest fighter pilot on the other side shot my butt down. 1 minute I'm doing Mach 2, chasing this MiG, just getting ready to blast him out of the sky. I already had the damn star painted on the side of my airplane. And this guy climbed up my butt and shot me down. I ejected at 18,000 feet at Mach 1 and free fell down to 10,000 feet, parachute open, and I knew it was going to be the crappiest day I ever had in my whole life.
Right.
The day had started off really great, but boy, it was sure ending badly.
What happened when you hit the ground? What was your experience? Because we've heard so many stories about...
Well, you know, I went to every damn survival school there was, every one of them. And all I did was plan and think about how I was going to evade and all that stuff. And as soon as I landed on the ground, I got piled on top by 30 folks. And all my grand plans went to hell just like that. So they hogtied me, threw me in the back end of a Jeep and took me to Hanoi. And I was in Hanoi Hilton. And I want to tell you, it was a crappy Hilton. Really it was. crummy location, no air conditioning, crummy food, surly waiters, and a crappy wine list. It was really a crappy Hilton.
There were a lot of guys in there who had been there for quite a while when you got there. Jeremiah Denton, Jim Stockdale, By Fuller, Kirk, names are popping out here, and as you know, dozens more. How many of those people did you run into? Were you separated from them, the guys that had been there a long time? John McCain, another one?
Well, they had a plan. They kept all the old guys separate from us because they didn't want us to tell them what had happened. They didn't want them to tell us what had happened. So the old guys were called the Fogs, funny old guys, and we were the FNGs, the funny new guys, and they...
No, I know there are some military pilots out there that know what you're saying.
So they had, we were divided. We were never supposed to see the other. But we did communicate and we did see. And one day I got to talk through the fence to a guy by the name of John McCain. And I'm going to tell all you folks, he's going to make a damn good president. He's a great guy.
At that point, was there any need at that point for you to learn the tap code?
Oh, yes, sir. Every POW learned the tap code. Once you got out of solitary confinement and you got in with the other POWs, the first thing to do was teach the tap code because that was the way we communicated. And it was something that we all learned immediately. That was part of our conditioning.
11 months later, would you try to describe what it was like when you were released and that whole process of being picked up?
Well, you know, you look back on your life and you say, when was the happiest day of your whole life? That was my happiest day of my whole life. When I got released from POW, I went from being incarcerated back to the land of liberty, the land of the free, and the land of the big PX, and man, I was a happy feller.
What is the Rosie O'Grady's balloon of peace?
Well, when I was in solitary confinement, I was in solitary confinement for 30 days, and a lot of POWs would build houses or do mathematical formulas, but I used my time to design a system to fly around the world solo in a balloon. That's what I spent all my time doing. When I got back, I started working to get a system to fly solo around the world. So I figured what I'd do is have a training flight. I would fly from the United States to Europe because that had never been done solo in a balloon. So I finally got a sponsor in Canada. And on the 14th of September, 1984, I took off from Caribou, Maine. I flew for 82 hours, and I landed in Cairo Montenotte, Italy. And The three questions I'm always asked about that flight. The first question is, what did you eat? Well, we ate food. The second question is, how did you go to the bathroom? Well, we had a potty. And the third question I'm always asked is, who was with you on that solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean?
I didn't ask you that.
You were thinking about it, though. Anyway, we set six world records. We did it just for the hell of it. We did it just to do it, and we had an awful lot of fun doing it.
Somebody told me that after you did all this stuff that you've described, and a lot more than I know you haven't described, that you and your wife started barnstorming.
We did. We barnstormed for 9 years in a D-29, new standard. We would start off every year at Sun and Fun. And we would have come here, but they had a monopoly. They wouldn't let us come here. But we would have, but we wasn't invited. But anyway, my wife and I barnstormed this airplane all over the United States. 1 year we went from Vero Beach, Florida to Tillamook, Oregon, 26 fuel stops. But we just had a ball, and in 9 years, we flew that airplane, we flew over 10,000 passengers, and we never had anybody that didn't like it. Everybody had a smile on their face, just like they did back in the 30s and the 20s, so we just had a ball doing it.
Ladies and gentlemen, a great American, a great aviator, Joe Kittinger. Thanks, sir. What a pleasure. What a pleasure. He's something else, isn't he? Yeah. Like all, as Joe just mentioned, like all advancements in aviation, it's incremental. You know, things just don't erupt out of whole cloth, new advancements. And that's certainly true of the space shuttle. It was the result of decades of, you know, incremental advances that got us to the point where the space shuttle, we now have more than 120 flights. I don't think there's anybody in the aviation business who is better able from personal experience to guide us through this kind of history of how did we get to the space shuttle than Colonel Joe Engel. Well, he used to be a colonel, now he's a major general. Joe Engel. Joe?
I wasn't sure where I was supposed to come from, over there.
Hey.
Hi, partner. How you
hey,
doing?
Partner. Great.
Which one are you sitting in?
I'm over here.
Okay.
You're there. You face them. Whatever.
Got it.
Again, a CV, because his CV is so fun to talk about. It's unbelievable. he's from Kansas. Was in high school when Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier. But after University of Kansas, aeronautical engineering degree, ROTC, earned his wings in the Air Force, flew F-100s, but then, coincidentally, it was Chuck Yeager, I believe, right, who recommended him to go to the test pilot school and eventually to train as an astronaut. Project pilot on the X-15. 10 of his 16 flights flew Mach 5 or faster. He flew over 3,800 miles an hour. He is one of only 8 of the 12 X-15 pilots who earned astronaut wings flying above 280,000 feet, and he is our youngest ever astronaut. He was only 32 years old. He was scheduled to fly on Apollo 17 with Gene Cernan and go to the moon, but the decision was made to put a geologist on that flight, and as it's even hard for me to say.
It's hard for me to say, too.
So he got dumped off Apollo 17, but stuck with the program, and of course went on to be in the left seat to pilot the approach and landing tests of the shuttle being busted off of the 747 out at Edwards, which was flown, of course, by Fitz Fulton. We're disappointed that Fitz could not be here tonight. He's a wonderful, fabulous man, an aviator, and was supposed to be with us, but he could not. So we're disappointed about that. Joe then went on to command two space shuttle flights. He is the only shuttle pilot to manually fly the shuttle from orbit, Mach 25, through the entire reentry process to landing and full stop, all manually. Only pilot ever to have done that with a space shuttle. Yeah. His first mission was STS-2 in 1981, when he flew that manual reentry. Second was 1985, spent 222 hours in space, and he's the only astronaut to fly two winged vehicles in space, so he has double astronaut wings. He is retired from NASA, retired from the Air Force as a Major General, has some 14,000 hours of flying time. This is Major General Joe Engel. So.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Appreciate that.
Looking back, we just talked, and Joe just mentioned about Kittinger, about incremental, and so that's my thought about the shuttle. Where do we go back to start? If we're looking back at the test processes, most of which I guess happened at Edwards, where do we start with that?
Joe's really right, and that I really applaud him for saying that you don't just magically get any place. It's incremental steps, small incremental steps made by thousands of people. I guess you really start back with the Wright brothers, but really the big breakthrough was being able to fly an airplane supersonic and to control an airplane that was going at supersonic speeds. And that was, of course, in 1947 when Chuck took the X-1 faster than the speed of sound. There was a whole series of rocket research airplanes that were designed specifically only to expand the performance envelope, both in speed and in altitude. I think initially, in all fairness, it was to learn about aerodynamics and aerothermodynamics, the heating that is involved as you go faster and faster through the atmosphere. But then they realized that, yeah, we're going to get higher and higher, and eventually we want to go into space. And so learning how to get into space with a winged vehicle and back down was another one of those objectives of that series of airplanes.
All right, the Bell X-1, mm-hmm. Chuck's flight, first supersonic. What were the key engineering things that were learned that allowed that to happen?
Controlling the airplane, learning how shock waves will form at the leading edge of a wing and form at the fattest part of the wing first, actually, the thickest part of the cord. And then we'll progress and move along the wing. And how once you get behind that thickest part of the airfoil, behind the shockwave, that the surfaces have very little effect, and sometimes no effect at all. The ailerons on the wing, on the tail surface, on the horizontal stabilizer, and the tail aft of the thick part of the cord where the elevator is, you lose pitch control. And in the rudder, you lose directional control. And I think the X-1, to me, one of its biggest contributions was not just going faster than the speed of sound, which is a pressure wave that while we're talking and the speaker goes out to the folks, and it's just a pressure wave going out. And that's what a shock wave is off an airplane, really. It's just that energy, wave of energy, kind of like the bow wave on a boat.
So what did Jack Ridley, the engineer working with Chuck and the team, what did they figure out that allowed them?
Yeah, Jack was really Chuck's partner on the X-1. He was not assigned to the program as a pilot, but he was a very brilliant engineer. And Chuck has mentioned him and given him credit for all kinds of things. And Jack really was the one who realized that Chuck was beginning to lose control. Chuck would come back and tell him that he was just losing pitch control. The airplane wasn't responding to pitch inputs as they incrementally got out closer and closer to Mach 1. Jack realized what was happening and knew that the elevator, which was behind the thickest part of the airfoil, was not going to see any undisturbed air and wasn't going to be effective in pitch control. So he realized that the whole tail was going to have to move, and rather than wait till they redesigned the whole tail, they had a big trim motor, not a big trim motor, but a trim motor, which was a pneumatic motor on a jack screw that would run the leading edge of the tail surface up and down. Jack said, "You know, I think we ought to try this. Chuck, you think you can handle this thing?" And Chuck said, "We'll give it a try," and it worked. It sure enough, it worked. And so they were able to control the airplane through Mach 1, and that whole concept of moving the whole tail of the airplane was very secretive at the time, because we were in a war with the bad guys, and
And that tail, flying tail, was put on the 86s. The original tail was removed from 86s and the flying slab was put on. And that's how we really had such a great kill ratio with the MiGs in
Korea. And I don't think we even told the Brits.
We didn't even tell the Brits, no.